Let me start off by saying you guys are awesome for being here so early on Time Change Day. I'm sure that all of the farmers from the First World War era would be proud to see how well you've dealt with daylight savings time, and I am too. So welcome to Can Gaming Make a Better World? Wow, what an interesting question. And we're going to get some answers from our incredible, amazing, astonishing, brilliant panel. And you're going to have some time to ask your questions. So it's going to be all around the best possible way you could spend like 4:30 in the morning on a Sunday. I'm Gabe Zuckerman. I'm the chairman of the Gamification Summit and author of two books on gamification. And I write the blog at gamification.co. And I am your moderator for today. And before we get started, I want to share with you, the audience, the rules of today's panel, which the panelists have been apprised of, but I will reiterate them for everybody's benefit. The first thing is panelists will have about 30 seconds to introduce themselves, and that will be the last time they're allowed to pitch. If they get pitchy after the 30-second intros, I will cut them off, right? I'm just going to give you a big, no pitching. Two, panelists must answer all questions honestly and truthfully. Oh, right? Wow. I'm serious. And if they don't, if we get marketing double talk, they're going to get the buzzer too. So the point is, we're going to get actual honest answers. We're going to learn some shit. It's going to be super festive. Okay.
Gabe, you left out one of the rules.
What is the other rule?
We weren't allowed to show up hungover.
Yes, none of them are hungover. None of them are hungover. So a round of applause for the panelists for not being hungover. Okay. Nice. All right, let's get started. Intros.
Okay, I'm Samantha Ski, and I work for Recycle Bank. We are an engagement platform, and we have integrated gaming dynamics since our inception prior to the creation of the gamification dialogue that's now so pervasive, thanks to Gabe. And what we're trying to do is change behavior by prodding people, encouraging people to recycle more, to take green action. We allow people to earn points. We encourage them through competition. We allow them to advance along a trajectory of eco-brilliance, and basically have found our way to some great success in changing consumer behavior through what would probably be referred to as gaming dynamics.
Great.
Very good. I feel very intimidated. I'm Adam Bosworth. Started a company called Kias. The goal was to improve the health habits of everyone in the world. Small goal.
Wow, tiny.
We learned the hard way. If we didn't do gaming, it didn't work. When we started doing gaming, we got about 100 times the engagement that we'd gotten before and way more sustained engagement. So we thought, well, this works. And we've been doing it ever since. And we are busy one company at a time making the world a happier, healthier, more productive place.
Okay, moving along.
That sounds awesome. I'm Nadia Girekova, and I'm a game designer and a UX designer, which means this week I went to GDC, and now I'm at South by Southwest. How many of you have been to both conferences? All right. I'm glad to see that there's people in the audience like that. So I work at Google in an organization called Google X. It's a new products division, and according to the New York Times, we're designing space elevators. It's not true. In my career, have worked in gaming at Leapfrog and Foundation 9, and I started working on using game thinking for user engagement at Razorfish, and at Google I work on a game advisory board where we help teams that are working to engage users with game dynamics, game mechanics. I worked on a game called Google a Day, which is a little puzzle that gives you a question every day that we publish in the New York Times, and you can answer it by searching. And we worked on similar ideas at Hotpot. And
awesome.
That's it.
Awesome. I love it. No, it's great. It's great. George.
How you doing? My name is George Weiner. I'm the Chief Technology Officer over at DoSomething.org. Out of curiosity, how many of you have heard of DoSomething.org?
Nice.
About 20 people.
And
put their hand
hopefully and the rest of my 15 seconds, the rest of you will know. Do Something is one of the largest organizations for teens and social cause. We bring teen action to scale. We run national cause campaigns as one of our mainstays. And recently, for example, we had a Teens for Jeans campaign raising over 1 million pairs of jeans across the country, working with Aeropostale and local stores where teens were raising jeans for homeless teens across the country. We put in a lot of game dynamics to these national cause campaigns. We'll be running 26 this year. I'll put out more case studies later, though.
Fantastic. Okay. Hashtag is up on the board. Feel free to tweet anything that gets you excited, but you will need to ask questions live and in person. So if you're feeling mildly autistic, don't tweet questions to me because I'm not checking it right now. Let's begin with this question for you all. So the world's kind of a fucked up and shitty place.
Now we're awake. Yay, yeah. Let's say fuck more.
Yeah. The world is often a fucked up place. It can be a beautiful place and a fucked up place. And so, but people throughout history have been looking for simple solutions to make the world a better place. Is gamification or gaming for good just another example in a long line of great ideas to make the world a better place that will ultimately not be successful? Go for it, whoever wants to start.
You're on it.
Well, I don't know about gamification making the world a better place. I do know that when we rolled out games to help people do things they otherwise just didn't have the ability to do, which was to change their health habits, we made their lives a better life. Every day I wake up, and the reason I do my company is I look at the feed, and there are people telling me that their life is in a different place, or they can't. Can you believe this is me, or can you believe I'm doing this?
Are we talking about weight loss, though, specifically?
No, we're talking about weight loss is the least of it. We're talking about eating the right things. We're talking about actually getting out and walking. We're talking about actually learning to deal with stress. And, you know, the thing that broke the camel's back here was the making it fun. And so from my point of view, making it fun is critical when you're asking people to do things that are hard.
I think that we're at Recycle Bank endeavoring to address a specific issue, which is the issue of waste and the negative impact of waste on our environment. And we're looking to change mainstream consumer behavior as a mechanism to address, I'm not pitching, I swear, but I'm just explaining,
okay.
As a mechanism to address this issue. So most people in the U.S. are horribly uneducated about what is recyclable and how to manage the waste that comes, that must be removed from their homes. We've employed gaming tactics as a mechanism to improve recycling rates. So very straightforwardly, we've been effective in increasing recycling and decreasing landfill. And in doing so, we've made people smarter and more motivated to recycle. So I'd say that's a very tactical approach with a very tangible outcome. And we believe it's made pockets of the country, at least, a better place in that people are now engaged in a process to save their communities and the planet and probably feel good about doing it, which is the reason they do it. It's not the macro of save the planet. It's the micro of, like, I'm not an idiot. I actually know where to put this plastic. So, I think in pockets we can really make a difference.
George?
To your question, then, like, game dynamics aren't going anywhere. I mean, look back at history. Herodotus was talking about staving off, in the case of using game dynamics to stave off hunger, where they were distracting themselves. I mean, basically the current dialogue, you know, within the last 5-6 years of us talking about it may die down, but this layer has always been there, will always be there. Hopefully the types of game dynamics that die are the ones that don't work for driving social action.
Yeah. So just want to pull it back to sort of one thing that you said, Adam. You talked about that you learned that when you made something fun, when you made an experience fun, it got people to do it. And you described getting an order of magnitude more engagement out of people. Can you tell us what is fun?
I think we're still figuring out what is fun. But it seemed that what was fun was three things. Number one was having to pick a strategy to win. Number two was having friends to do it with who were validating you. So the social was really important. And number three was some degree of feeling like this was unpredictable, You had to basically pick your way through. How do I win? How do I do better in the game? But without having unclear rules, and we're still figuring that one out. It turned out the rules have to be clear, but the outcome can't be guaranteed.
So strategy, sociability, and some degree of surprise and delight. Mm-hmm. Nadia, does that resonate with you as the way to make things fun?
I try to solve problems when I'm using game mechanics, so I think that when that's the right way to solve the problem, that's the right thing to do. But I wouldn't pepper it on everything.
You wouldn't do that with everything?
Not with everything.
Do you think not everything has to be fun? Is that what you're saying?
I don't think there's a button that you need to push and like make it fun and that ultimately is making it, it's solving everything. I think there are contexts where it's appropriate to actually be serious, but rewards and incentives are still applicable. So it's not like salt and pepper that you put on every dish.
Interesting. George, do you agree with that? Not everything should be fun?
I mean, I agree to disagree. Everything has to be fun in some sense. I mean, Do Something tackles a number of different causes. Some are very serious. For example, the Teens for Genes example, a third of all homeless are under the age of 18. I mean, it's a tremendously serious issue that we bring attention to. But at the same time, a lot of the schools that were participating, we were in a quarter of all high schools across the country, were actually in micro competitions with each other, putting their principals on the roof in order to like raise another level of, 1,000 pairs of jeans. So they're already doing this on the ground to make it fun around a serious issue. We've also seen the same types of engagement increase when people are having fun in the act of, helping a cause that matters.
Yeah. It sounds like you're saying that in that case, competition was fun. So you used a kind of competition mechanic?
Yeah, well, we actually, to be completely honest, we're terrified of competition when we're designing these games because we don't think there should be a loser in social change, and that has kind of like made us shy away from it. We're terrified of it. But at the same time, two of our top 10 schools, each raising around 7,000 pairs of jeans, were competing with each other. These two great schools in Tennessee took it upon themselves to do this. So there's something to be said for the proper application of competition if they opt into it.
So when you say stuff like, we don't think there should be losers in social change, like every libertarian and right-wing person in the world goes, ow, fuck you! This is what's wrong with our children today.
Yeah,
there can be no winners.
Big losers.
I think that's totally wrong. I mean, it's funny. Key has changed me as a parent. We used to tell people the unvarnished truth about what their health meant. And about half of Americans, their health news is not good. Just look around the Dallas airport when you leave. You look
very, prognosis is positive for you.
You're the classic TED-Med, oh, we're super fit, we need to have our data. That is not the people we're selling to. And, the bottom line is, when we gave people bad news, they just turned the dial. They turned it instantaneously because it was negative feedback. The moment we made it positive, the moment we said, hey, you did a great thing, you walked half a mile this week,
yeah,
they were there. They went, whoa, I did a great thing. Maybe I could walk a mile next week. And, that model. So, I learned, this is a funny analogy, but when I was changing my baby's diaper, sometimes he acts up. So I'd say, you're a good boy, as opposed to, what the hell are you doing? And, it improved the diaper changing experience. I think fundamentally, it's a lousy strategy to yell at people and a great strategy to reward people for doing the right thing.
Samantha, would you agree with that?
We find shaming people has not caused them to recycle more. So we would shame them all day long if it were effective, but I think it's not. It's a depressing topic. The environment, and it's particularly depressing for the mainstream who's not 100% on board with the issue or with the actions that they're being asked to take. So we have certainly found that celebrating the wins and not criticizing people, which is often what mainstream U.S. consumers have felt from the sustainability movement, is actually really, really powerful. So I would agree on the topic that we're in. I think shame, humiliation, loserdom might work in some areas of behavior change, but in environmental action, it's not effective.
So positive reinforcement is a great thing. I'm a huge believer in it as well as the main thing, but just to go back to this, the comment that George made about, they're not being losers in the process of making social change. Nadia, isn't it true that, like, all game designs have to have some degree of failure in them?
Mm-hmm. Well, failure is only applicable when there's a path set. So one thing that's really engaging about games is that there's a sense of mastery that you're progressing towards. And along that path of mastery, if you're failing, it's only in the context of trying to achieve something. I remember a study by Nicole Lazaro that said that gamers fail in games about 80% of the time, but they actually really love it because they're very clear on what they're trying to get better at and they're very engaged in the process. So games have put failure in a very specific way in context because they know that you're on a journey and you're very engaged with what you're doing, and that's why it doesn't feel like failure. And I think that attitude towards mistakes and uncertainty is very useful in real life. So when gaming meets the positive psychology movement, we can get a new attitude towards failing and basically say that it's fine. If you know that you're learning, then you're basically like just going forward and you're enjoying what's happening. It's just failure is a type of feedback. And if you have that attitude, you can be a lot more successful.
So positive reinforcement and failure in your model are not necessarily mutually exclusive.
It depends whether you're fixed, where you're growth oriented or fixed oriented. If you're fixed and you feel like this is what I know and I'm never going to know more, then failure feels really bad. But if you're growth oriented and you're saying I'm in this experience in order to learn, to gain mastery, to gain new skills, then failure is not a problem. It's actually a part of your journey.
Yeah. Were you going to say something?
I think that it's important, though, that in the context of failure, you have the sense that success is achievable. You know, this is the part of the mastery issue, is if you're playing a game and you're not making it, but you can tell that you're going to. I think that's a profoundly different statement than if you realize, I can't do this.
Right. Futility is not motivating. That's something we've found with environmental action as well, that if you feel tiny and sort of irrelevant or like your actions are futile and that you're not ever going to get there and you can't do everything right, so why do anything in the environmental spectrum? It's a wonderful out.
And conversely, if it's too easy, that's really bad too, right?
I mean, fundamentally, everybody's a winner. That's no fun.
You have to keep moving the bar on people so that they're constantly challenged to succeed, but it's constantly attainable. I think that's part of the really. We're scared to death of competition as well, because obviously we don't want people who are overweight to give up. Mm-hmm. But and at the same time, the leaderboard motivates some group of people. You know, so we're constantly trying to balance this. Group of people who want to compete with a group of people. We're trying to get people to compete against themselves, not against each other.
Those are lots of really, really good insights, and we're going to come back to things like leaderboards and their efficacy in a little while. But so, George, back to your kind of, after having listened kind of to this scope, and especially want to zero in on what Samantha said about futility is bad. How do you overcome that, especially when you're dealing with young people and trying to get them to become engaged? What are some techniques that you've been using to overcome maybe a sense of powerlessness or futility?
Yeah, so, I mean, for example, if I were in this room right now to say, go out and cure youth homelessness. I'll wait. Go. Now. Not much action going on. Every time Do Something comes up with a social action campaign, we have three rules: no money, no car, no adult. We immediately lower the barriers to entry so that anyone can play. From there, we then get into the process of saying, all right, what is the cause we're addressing? How do we make it fun? Sometimes we do a better job than others. And when we, really look at this, competition, I think you're exactly right in saying, if you're going toward this larger goal and you know you're on your way toward that, it's all right to come in second place when you raise 7,000 pairs of jeans. And what we're trying to do is Do Something is each one of these campaigns is now only an episode, and to looking at a bigger picture of 26 campaigns over the course of the year, how many did you do? And by the way, this is going to be over 10 years. So we're trying to pull back so that when you do have these, micro failures, it's really toward a larger sense of mastery of social change.
It's similar, kind of, Samantha, to what you were saying, in terms of, which I made a note about, which is about putting kind of just one task in front of people. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, George, similarly, you're trying to take the pressure off of, like, solve youth homelessness and focus people on, like, a single task. Mm-hmm. Is that, Samantha, is that, like, I mean, recycling, even bigger question, right? Like,
yeah, well, I think that the whole, well, starting with the biggie of the environment, which is just so in need of a brand makeover as a problem, because it seems so daunting, it's depressing, my kids are going to be on a melting, like, you know, road warrior situation. It's just not awesome. And so I think that breaking that down into components where you can feel like, oh, I rock, I recycled my paperboard, fuck, I know what paperboard is, I'm so smart, like, things like that will allow your mainstream folks who might not be in the room, but there's lots of them, and they have lots of waste that they could manage better. Breaking it down into components that are biteable and addressable is very effective. It doesn't get at the problem, and it doesn't allow for the, like, pounding on the table about, you know, the myriad things we should be changing every day and the way that we manufacture and source.
Do a lot of people in the environmental movement take exception with that strategy because they don't think you're doing, like, enough mission?
Oh, for sure. Also, we're, like, paying people to recycle, basically, which is kind of sketchy. So I think that it's definitely addressing the mainstream and saying that it's okay to do two things a day that might be progressing your eco IQ or your eco awareness. It's a relatively new approach, and yes, it definitely carries some controversial wake.
So is that? So I think it's very interesting, and there's some stuff I want to come back to about incentives and rewards. Mm-hmm. But so, Adam, what we basically have heard from Samantha and George is that it's better to focus people on just, like, literally the next task. Is that the same thing in health behavior change, or do we really need to keep them focused on the big question?
It depends on the person. We fundamentally do constrain how many things you can do, because if we give you more than three, you don't do them. But there are folks who basically say, look, I just want to work on walking. There are folks who say, I just want to work in getting to a certain reasonable waistline. And there are people who say, I want to be a healthier person. And those have very different goals. So the game has to be flexible enough to accommodate people who want to be holistic and people who want to be one task at a time. What we do know, though, is it's really easy to overload people. You know, even in World of Warcraft, they sort of disclose things to you one feature at a time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we try and write our games very similarly. So we don't give you the fun new toy until you've mastered the basics.
Do you think, Nadia, that this kind of stepwise approach, the slow reveal of complexity that all the panelists are kind of talking about in their own way, do you think that that's, like, an essential feature of how these things work from a game design standpoint?
Well, so sometimes when you're designing a space, you want to allow people to explore everything and to not know what their goals are. And sometimes you want to be very clear that they should know what their goals are and that they'll be led one step at a time. It depends on who you're dealing with and what is their basically tolerance for uncertainty. If you're dealing with a user that's basically super busy and is only going to spend about a second on your website, you really need to grab them, explain what your game or what your experience is going to be about, and make sure that they're successful within the first few actions that they take. Make sure they understand what it is about, that they take action, and that they're successful. If you're dealing with someone who, on the other hand, has already purchased your product, like a lot of games, they're already boxed experiences you've downloaded, they have a little bit more time on their hands. If they're more experienced gamers, their risk tolerance and uncertainty tolerance is higher, and then you don't necessarily need to give them all the goals. You can trust them to figure out the environment, to poke around, and to find something to do and something to strive for. But it depends on the user you're dealing with.
So the higher the user's upfront investment, the more likely they are to spend their own time after that investment to explore, to discover, to be comfortable with some uncertainty. Is that the principle?
There are some urban games, for example, that I have participated in, where you don't pay anything; they're free, and so, but they still require you to explore the world and to know very little about the rules. So I wouldn't say that it's a hard and fast rule.
I think an unsung hero in some of these games can be the feed. If you have progressive disclosure, but you have a public feed, mm-hmm. fundamentally people are talking about things you're not seeing yet, and now you're incented. And you're incented because people are playing the game are getting to do things you're not getting to do. Mm. And so it's not like anyone's preaching to you or saying you should be doing this. It's like, crap, they're getting to do this. Why am I not getting to do this?
Mm-hmm. So what Nadia was, one of the things that Nadia was just talking about, the onboarding experience, that first moment of a user's experience being immediately rewarding and providing some like positive instant feedback, that's something we very closely associate with Zynga and other kind of social game designs that really focus on pioneering how good that kind of first minute can be. How do we bring something like that to a complicated personal challenge, Adam? How do we bring that positive immediate reinforcement to something that, like health behavior change, that could take weeks or months or years?
I think that's exactly what Samantha said. I mean, fundamentally, we're trying to teach people that they can do something where they get rewarded. We don't want to give them large numbers of things. We want to do exactly what Samantha and Nadia said. We give them a couple of simple things to do that are fun. And where if they do it, we go, great job. You just got points. You just got elevated. And they're going, whoa. You know, people respond incredibly well to getting points. I don't know how to overstate this. You know, as a person who's not a gamer, and as a person who looks at the mail from our customers every day, the only time they ever get mad at us is if they think they were shorted a point or someone else got too many points. And it is astonishing how effective points are in this regard at just getting people to go, whoa, I just got one of these. I want to do that again. I'll get another one.
So points are a powerful motivator. What else motivates and drives behavior, Samantha?
I think points are interesting, and we could talk about that one for a long time because they have a huge range of value. We employ points. To some people, they mean a ton, and we would have a similar description of the reaction and the upset if someone feels they've been slighted their points. There's social status associated. There's monetary value in some cases. If points, you know, points also can be diluted to mean very little. If there's not sort of an equity component that's consistent. So points definitely. We look at the social status component, which I think we're also all describing, both through the feed and the knowledge of what others are doing, which is a really powerful driver of behavior change, to see kind of what your neighbor's doing and to compare yourself to other peers. So again, sort of the norming that you can generate through showcasing others' behaviors, especially others with whom we relate and identify, is a very powerful motivator. You know, all of the pat on the back validation that's sort of showcasing the impact of your work. So if it's within the eco space that you just did this thing, I'm going to put it in very recognizable terms for you so that you understand how much energy you've saved. Or it's the sort of that old model of like a buck to help this adorable kid in Africa eat today. Something relatable that is, again, not oppressive, but is instead sort of celebratory. So we showcase the value back to the member or the user. We give them some type of incentives. If they prefer monetary, they're going to get monetary. If they prefer social status, they'll get that. If it's some complex, you know, combination of those factors that most motivates them, then we'll design for that model. And then, yeah, just publishing and showcasing actions among peer groups.
What about you? What do you think, George, at Do Something? What have you guys found in terms of reward models that work?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think to encapsulate a lot of these points, we're talking about feedback loops, whether you're getting points, affirmations, messages, social recognition, the feedback loop game at Do Something. We actually had an interesting case study last summer where we ran something, the scavenger hunt, where it was mainly SMS-based, another key tool that Do Something uses to talk to about 200,000 teens a week on. And this game was actually all on SMS. You signed up and immediately were entered into a 10-day, basically every single day there was a different cause, and we would send you quick instant messages of, you know, go hold, you know, a quick car wash for a cause, or go for, fold paper cranes for Japan at the time. And each day there was four different micro missions. They were reporting back. The interesting thing, of the 13,000 people that signed up for this, we had a 26% response rate. 27,000 actions were recorded. To put that in context for the 26% response rate, for Teens for Genes that I was just mentioning, we had closer to a 2% response rate, though the top of the funnel was significantly larger. So this is something that we're going to be blowing the doors off this year and hopefully coming back with a larger case study on it.
I have a little tip on changing behavior. So there's something very simple that a lot of my clients and colleagues forget, is that is to remind people. The power of reminders is something that, you know, your grandmother knows and has probably practiced on you when you're leaving for school. So when somebody is signing up for your application, it's really useful to think about what is an opportunity to remind them to come back in a way that's friendly and not annoying. Whether you're going to send them an email to remind them to finish something that they started, or you're going to, you know, send them some newsletter or content that's going to be relevant for them. Again, not spamming users, but finding clever ways to remind people to come back.
Yeah, we found that was critical, and we did it a little differently, which is, in fact, this is by far and away the most important thing in Kiosk. When people are going to fall off the wagon when trying to be healthy. They are I did it last night. Came in the hotel, it was midnight, tired,
you know,
did not eat the healthiest food. And
I thought you went on a bender.
And when I was too tired to go.
It's a shame.
Did you have fried chicken?
I had chicken wings. So, you know, with buffalo sauce. So, you know, the key point is, though, that what we found is if we left you on your own, fun or not, feed or not, points or not, 100 days in, 20% of the people were engaged. If we made you a team of people who you knew socially and where the team depended on you and you depended on them, 80%.
Totally.
20 to 80. That's mind-boggling. So, like, everything we do these days when we onboard you is about getting you to join a team, because basically we regard you as a lost cause if we didn't get you to join a team. If you're so motivated that you can do it on your own, you're probably already fit.
Right.
And so fundamentally, you know, the thing we do for the reminders is the team. Why? Because then it's not the game nagging you. It's your coworkers going, dude, we're all going to fail if you don't, you know, get back on the wagon.
There
so it's
go.
A reminder strategy using social pressure from your peers.
Cool.
So teams can be powerful, and I think we see that a lot. I think that's a really, really good observation. I want to take everybody back to the incentives and rewards discussion for a second, though. So one of the things that people get really – some people get really nervous about is this whole idea that we're going to incentivize and reward people for actions that they should be doing altruistically, which is often a place where this discussion, gaming for good, bumps up against – certain kinds of criticism. So, you know, we all know, I think, the basic argument, Samantha, I think that you kind of made at the top, which is, but we're doing good stuff here. Is this sustainable? And is this a good is this good for society to go down this pathway?
Totally. I think it's... Oh, totally.
No, you go.
Rock on. Okay. I think it's... I think that the reason we're talking about gaming... mechanics as mechanisms to make the world better is that we found that when a lot of other tactics or approaches are failing, and again, referencing the U.S. Consumers, citizens specifically, there's a lot of things people are not doing that universally I think we can agree would make a lot of sense for them, for society, etc. So given that attention spans are tiny, that there is so much content and community to be absorbed and to be played with daily, I think we're turning to gaming because so many other things are not working. Government as a whole, maybe, is not as effective as some gaming dynamics in terms of engaging people in their communities and their own personal well-being. So I think that because that's the happy side. On the flip side, if you're only going to recycle or eat properly if you're given points, and you must be given points forevermore in order to embrace those behaviors, we're also not in great shape. So I think what we're looking to do is find the tipping point when you've done something enough times that it becomes habitual, and you can begin to pull back the rewards, or the rewards can become more
Scalable.
Right, scalable, self-created, etc. So I think creating structured, organized, reproducible models is what this is all about. It's the notion that, because if without that goal, this is just a really expensive way to get people to, you know, put something in a bin or behave properly in terms of their health or their thoughts about others.
So Nadia, what were you going to say?
What I was going to say is that we are only learning how reward systems work and how they engage our brain. I had a lovely discussion with Ian Bogost, who is the designer of the cow clicking games. Have you guys played that on Facebook?
Cow clicking.
Cow clicking.
Yeah.
Ian Bogost is someone who started. He's a professor, and he's someone who's very thoughtful about games and serious games and persuasive games. He was very critical of the gamification movement and the zingification of games. And in order to express his disdain, he created a game called Cow Clicking on Facebook, where you get to click cows, and that's all you get to do. And he has the points and the leveling and the ability to add friends to get more points and the ability to buy points so that you can click on more cows. And that was basically his critique of Zynga. What surprised him is that he created a mass success.
I saw that coming.
So what Ian says about gaming is that it's a dark art. We don't actually know how it works. Does it mean we're going to sit with our arms crossed until scientists figure it out and do nothing in the field that engages users? No. We're going to keep going so that we can find what are the things that work. And every year, with every new experiment, we're basically coming with better results. So if you go to Facebook right now to play the cow clicking game, you see that there's nothing to click on because they had a rapture where basically he didn't want to deal with the cows anymore, and he created a rapture. So he basically like emptied all the slots. So now it's kind of like an empty container, but people are still going and clicking because they're thinking that it's really interesting, like the aboutness of that game and like the commentary that it's making. There's other people who have basically made friends on that game, don't want to still keep coming back. So someone who is a professor and one of the most thoughtful persons on the subject was really surprised about how little he knows about what's rewarding to people and what they're interested in doing. So one thing, for example, that I learned this year about rewards is that I'm always looking about first rewards that are appropriate, but also the minimum required amount of reward. There's a very interesting study by Dan Ariely in the book The Upside of Irrationality, where he did an experiment, a cash experiment in India, where he let people play a game for different amounts of money. One was a very small amount of money, the second was like the equivalent of maybe a week's worth of earnings, and the third was kind of like the equivalent of like a CEO compensation, much more than the typical person would be getting. And he found that the people who were getting paid a lot more are not performing better, they're performing worse, because they're really stressed out by how much their lives could be impacted mm-hmm. by playing that simple game that could really change the monetary state. So that was basically a lesson, the minimum required amount.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is really interesting. So George, in your case, you know, getting teens to do stuff, who can argue with that?
No one.
how do you feel about this concept of providing these rewards, providing this reward structure for what's supposed to be just altruistic teens helping each other out?
It terrifies the crap out of me, Gabe.
Okay.
To put that in context, if you create a system wherein the game and the goal is an extrinsic reward, what happens when you win? How many of you played Pac-Man?
Oh.
How many of you still play Pac-Man as aggressively as you used to? Put down your hands, sir. There's just no way. Thank God. You're about to ruin my point. My point, right, you're in this process, hopefully, you know, either you're extrinsically or intrinsically motivated to oversimplify all, you know, incentive bases. And so I am terrified of creating a generation, as we're working with one of the largest organizations that do something for engaging young people in social action, that we're going to say, hey, you're doing this for this carrot, you're doing this for this scholarship,
but
this pizza party.
George, I want to just challenge you on that. That exact same analogy would be any social service question you would have asked mm-hmm. from people's teens to their adulthood. That falls off a cliff in general in the population too. Not just Pac-Man, how many volunteering for your community, doing stuff to get into college, right?
So if you at least design it within episodes, but if you're saying that you only do it to get into college, which is, example, the fear motivator behind why scholarships are so effective as an incentive for us, if you're able to design those in episodes, but your overarching goal is not to get into college with this or to get to your, you know, short-term epic win, then you're doing it in the right way. But again, I prefer intrinsic motivators to the extrinsic now that game. So I'd rather.
I think we're all going to jump on this one because it's interesting. But it doesn't terrify me because a huge component of what we're trying to address, and I think all of us are trying to address, is ignorance or lack of knowledge of the subject matter. So we have a happy stat of 78% of people would like to claim that they would like to lead a more sustainable lifestyle if they only knew how, and that 70% of casual social gamers are women and moms. We've got a great setup to educate these people, and through games, a conduit that they find fun and rewarding, educate them on how to lead a more sustainable lifestyle. Once they have the knowledge, some bit might pull back if you remove the incentive, but if you simply do not know how to recycle a cereal box properly, then, and we can incentivize you to gain that knowledge and to understand it, I would say that some of those modalities would exist with health as well. Then, you know, once you have the knowledge, I would hope that it would stick with you beyond the life of the incentive.
I think it's a red herring. I mean, fundamentally, there's two issues here that are being conflated and shouldn't be. There's the incentive to start playing the game. That's the only place that I think cash has any role ever. Mm-hmm. It's just getting people off the dime. Once they play the game, it's about habit formation, just like Samantha said. Fundamentally, you've got about 100 days, call it 10 weeks, to try and create some better habits. And if you're successful in getting people to do the right thing week after week for 10 weeks, they're going to stick to it. It's like, you know, getting a car to move when you're pushing on the street is hard. Once it's moving, it's moving. Mm-hmm. And it's much, much easier for people to sustain a habit than build one. So, you know, once that happens, social status, the fun of the game, and all the rest of it will propel you. And we found this. I mean, we learned empirically at KIAS. We went from $30 a head at rewards to 5 to 1 to 0 with no diminishment in engagement whatsoever.
We had a similar experience,
So cash didn't matter. But it's interesting, Adam, because in your category, in the health category, which I'm sure many people in the room are also in the health category, in your category, there's like real money at stake in behavior change.
Oh, yeah, $7,500 per person of lifestyle costs.
Right?
Yeah.
So why don't you just spend that money?
Spend that money on them?
Why not just take that money from health insurance, you know, get the health insurers to give people money to like stop being fat? Why doesn't that work?
Because it's, to be blunt, because it's a hell of a lot easier for an HR person to administer a cash-free program. One they can roll out virally and effortlessly in a morning. The other one they have to worry about taxes, offsets. It's much more about the impedance mismatch of someone in HR rolling this out than it is the cash.
Yeah, we have a similar situation in that recycling, there's great value in the commodities. There's a monetary reason to recycle for a community, for an individual. And we want to take that monetary driver and represent it and present it back to the individual so that they begin to perceive these materials as having value. So I think that there's a really important component to the first stage that has to do with, at least in our case, showcasing the actual financial value of the action, which seems, again, to be more motivating to people who are not motivated fundamentally by the planet is melting discussion.
And so, George, in your case, assuming that there's not buckets of cash being thrown at your problem, what do you think about using cash as a way of motivating teenagers to do things? It seems like they could be motivated with cash pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just give them cash?
Cash is a slippery slope. I mean, initially you think of like if you do this, you'll get this money, and that's why like a lot of jobs suck. If you're trying to make it more of a fun game than now that, more of a lottery type of win, we found it is much better. The application of money more effectively is used for us in the case of scholarships, and the way we present those has got a lot of nuance, and we look at the data, but that both attracts the type of teen we're interested in and is one of the better rewards we found. But in the case of scavenger hunt, I mean, we gave away these super cheap but funny sunglasses as the gateway thing, and
you know, we laughed about it because there was like stacks of like 10,000 sunglasses literally sitting in our office. We're like, this is stupid. But then we looked at the data, and it was a great way to get people in the door. And then from there, we applied the, you know, this game that folks played. And, you know, hopefully the game, even when the, you know, money runs out, people continue the behavior you were trying to incent. And I hope people are tracking that when you design this, because I think it all comes down to the way you apply those types of rewards.
So I have one. I'm going to ask another question. But if you guys are ready to, if you guys have a question, put your hands up. The folks from the team bring you a mic, and I'm just going to ask the panel one more question, and we'll grab this gentleman back here who had his hand up right here. Just hold your question for 1 second. So Nadia, because it came up a couple of times.
All right.
Scavenger hunts.
Okay.
Come up a lot in this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Should we just be doing scavenger hunts with every Game for Good challenge?
You keep looking for the button, Gabe. There is no button. There is no button that we can press.
Button. There's no button we can push. Okay.
So it's scavenger hunts can be incredibly interesting. There's some people that love them. I personally don't, but I have friends that love them. If your audience is likely to get engaged by a scavenger hunt, then you should do it.
Are there some characteristics of audiences that like things like scavenger hunts that you can think of?
Nerdy.
Nerdy. Nerdy people. Nerdy. All right, we're going to take some questions. Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi.
With love. With love.
It's okay. A quick question about the game experience that says the in the game we could make the real life better. Because taking experience from the gaming, we can construct our life better. War games, about war games.
Yeah,
what there is. What do you think about could be good, bad, that experience of war games?
So can war games, so just to rephrase that in this way, how can war games be used to improve the world or make it worse? How are they used to make it worse or make it better?
That is like a long and awesomely heated discussion that, and if we believe that the behaviors you... That you employ in the context of a game are equatable to what you're going to do offline, then there's some interesting controversy, I would imagine, there. And we're hoping that you learn to recycle online. But it's not the process of putting the thing in the bin that you're going to then go simulate that. You know, you simulate that experience online and then you go do it offline. It's that you learn that this goes in, you know, this material goes in this bucket, this material goes in that bucket. So... I don't believe that what you do online is the same. You're just going to jam that behavior right into your offline world. I believe it's more of an education platform. So I hope that if you, you know, so the argument that the World of Warcraft is going to make a bunch of, you know, killers out of our kids is a super interesting dialogue. But I don't see it through the same lens that I see some of the things we're trying to teach to. That's as far as I'm going to go, because it's too hot of a topic.
You know, one of the things on my soapbox about that is that when there's always a soapbox.
Go.
When like nonprofits and NGOs and do-goodery people want to use games, usually they choose a fairly pedantic approach to doing so. So I want you to understand why nuclear arms are really dangerous. So I'm going to make a game in which the core premise is the world is ending because nuclear arms are going to destroy the world. And so the truth is, where they always end up getting stuck is they make games that make the people at the nonprofits feel good, but no fucking consumer wants to play. And they end up getting caught by, they get caught by not getting that nobody wants to play the game in which we can't have nuclear meltdown, or the nuclear meltdown happens after. And the place where they really have trouble is understanding how letting people blow up the world might be the best way to understand why that's bad. And actually making that the core action that they learn from.
Also, get out of your system.
Yeah.
Like, if I got to blow shit up, it'd be better to do it there. But that's a slippery slope also.
I'm unworried about war games empirically, which is to say, I watched my son in horror sort of obsessively play World of Warcraft for what appeared to be forever. Mm-hmm. And it turned out in the end, it taught him two very important lessons. One was the value of teamwork and building support networks. And the other one was the value of dealing with adversity. And he's happily doing a startup in Beijing these days, you know, and all is the most nonviolent person I know. And I ended up concluding that, you know, for a certain group of teenage boys, they're going to play war games. And the issue is not are they going to play war games, but what are they going to learn from it? And they turn out to learn better lessons than you'd think.
Great. We'll take this question here.
I have no doubt about everyone's wonderful intentions, but but
apparently you do.
Are you
nice starter?
Yeah, we know you do actually. So just ask.
And the amount of knowledge and the fine print knowledge that you're getting on all this. Are you ever afraid that this could be knowledge used for totally different manipulative reasons? Do you ever get freaked out by that?
Let's talk about the dark side. Dark side?
I want you. You have such a good answer on this. Can you be a panelist for a second?
I'm interested in hearing your
I'll give
opinion.
You an optimistic answer. In order to create an experience for someone, you have to be incredibly empathic. You need to understand who they are, what moves them. My optimistic answer would be that game designers are very empathic people and they really care about making the world better. And the more people that learn from them, the more people are going to develop that empathy, which is an essential tool for design. And that's my optimistic story, that they think that as more people pick up these skills, we're going to have a better world, not a worse world.
But I think there's no doubt you could use it for malice. If you're effective in changing behavior by designing an experience, I have no illusions that everyone who's designing a game is doing so to provide some general human betterment. Totally.
I'm going to give the pessimistic answer.
Okay, thank you.
Quote Hannah Arendt's The Banality of Evil. At the end of the day, there's no doubt in my mind that the same things we're using to learn to motivate behavior are going to be used by people who are trying to change to motivate the behavior of their employees in ways that are not so good. The only comment I have about that is, there is another famous quote that most people live, quiet lives of desperation. The companies that I'm talking about are going to make their employees do this regardless. And at least it'll be fun for them to be made to be doing it instead of not. But I do think it will be used to basically push people to do things they otherwise wouldn't do.
And I'll give you the kind of neither optimistic nor pessimistic answer to that, which is, I'm a big believer in disclosure, and so one of the things that's really interesting to me about this discussion is that in past evolution of persuasive technologies like television or music or the printing press, we didn't have a dialogue in which people said, I am concerned that this technology will be used to oppress people. Huh? And so as a result of this evolution, which already I think is an amazing thing about people, that we're able to do this and have this discussion. As part of this, what will be very interesting is I think we're seeing more disclosure, and I definitely push everybody that I work with to disclose the kind of gamified content of what it is that they do, which I think is the only way for there to be some level of positive direction out of this, let's say.
Had a great answer.
We should just start with that. No, I'm just kidding.
Sir.
What do you think about cooperation between companies like Rovio and NASA, government institutions. So between gaming companies and government institutions, might it bring something new?
So what do we think about the government getting all up in games and gamification? Are there cool things coming out of that?
Ooh, all my libertarian flair suddenly starts.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in some ways, George, your stuff has some government support, does it not?
Our system. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've worked with government partners. I mean, the EPA worked with us on a social Facebook game around called E-Mission, cleaning up a beach, offline action, and we integrated there. I think some of the stuff I see around big apps, data.gov, challenge.gov, they're beginning to get into it and in a lightweight way, hopefully begin to incentivize crowdsource solutions. And in that direction, I'm most hopeful, I think.
We're funded in part by municipalities, by local municipalities who want to increase recycling and decrease and diversion from landfill because they recognize the value of the commodities and want that for their community. I would not recommend that government agents do their own game design because it might not be the most engaging experience. But if they hire Nadia, I'm all for it if it's for a positive end.
All right.
I think we have one more question. Time for one more question right back there.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you'd pretend this is a group of superintendents of school systems, and what would you tell them that they need to know about games for good?
I think it's a great question. I love the education industry's like the gamification and ed. And we haven't talked a ton today about direct educational topics, but if you guys have opinions about what the education system should do with gamification in school,
they should embrace it with both feet. I mean, most
that's weird.
That's so
like
weird.
Like a monkey.
Whatever.
What an image.
The analogy was poor, but you know, my dad started a school, and my dad didn't believe in technology, and he was just wrong about this. I mean, it's the games can be a huge win. One of the most funs I ever had was a summer at Cornell doing advanced calculus, but it was a self-paced model. You could just do it at whatever speed you want. And so, of course, we all competed for how fast we could go. And, you know, turning that kind of material into a game and social and points and the rest of it is just going to turbocharge people learning that kind of thing that you can learn online. You can't learn to appreciate Shakespeare online necessarily, but you certainly can learn a huge amount online that we don't do today, and games can be a huge force for improving that.
I think it's. I think they should. I agree that they should embrace gaming with both feet, and their legs, and their arms, and their whole person.
Okay,
here's what I think is fascinating: is that I think the education platform is often thought, you know, put down that game, focus up here, and if we can switch that to like get on in there and learn that much more and engage with your community, connect with other people who are at the same level as you, who can sort of push you a bit. But I think that is a massive change in dynamic, from put down the device that might distract from the chalkboard or the front of the room to, like, let's employ that experience and allow kids to design their own games and to address their own problems and to have teachers really, you know, looking for achievement through gaming experience. And I think that the one we didn't talk about, one flip side of this whole thing, which is the notion of sort of addiction, obsession, and fetishism that might evolve from an over-connection with certain types of games. But I think that is the educator's great fear, is that it's not only not educational to be involved in gaming, but it's actually distracting from the content they should be absorbing. So I'd say it's both necessity and opportunity, and should be embraced with both feet.
Well, I want to
even if invited.
And so with that, I want to thank our panelists for their awesome, 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 awesome insight. Thank all of you. Thank you very much.